Hello, everyone. Good to see you all. Hello to those on the webcast. I saw two interesting signs on the way over that I thought I'd share. The first one's for the Fosters. Apparently, someone's interested in having Fosters. They're just saying Foster's interested, so you may have apparently a place to go to that you'd be welcome at. And then the second sign, which I found hilarious, it says, now hiring, sliced turkey for $7.49 a pound. It's like we're missing something here. I'd like to start today by reviewing with you all a statement. A statement written by the Apostle Paul to the church located at Ephesus over two millennia ago. So if you could, please turn over with me over to Ephesians 4 in verse 1. Ephesians 4 in verse 1. I'll give everyone a moment or two to get there. Ephesians 4 verse 1. The apostle wrote the following to the church. He wrote, I therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you to walk worthy of the calling with which you were called, with all lowliness and gentleness, with long-suffering, bearing with one another in love, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. There is one body and one Spirit, just as you were called in one hope of your calling. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is above all and through all and in you all. And we'll stop there. This is what the Apostle Paul wrote to the congregation at Ephesus. Now, these six verses are by no means the only series of important verses in the overall text of the letter. Ephesians is a fantastically rich, rich letter from front to cover, or front to back, excuse me. And it is, honestly, if you talk about the letters of Paul, probably one of the more approachable writings. However, it's this section in Ephesians 4 that I want to build the sermon around today. It is home base, so to speak. We're going to spend the majority of our time here because, as we just read, it is jam-packed. I mean, it is overflowing at the seams in meaning. And I posit or suggest, brethren, that in relation to the upcoming holy days, it has significant relevance. It's hard to believe it is only 10 days away. Only 10 days away. If the Passover and the days of unleavened bread mean what they do, what we as the church, as converted individuals, believe they represent, based on what the doctrines and teachings of the Bible state, and they do mean those things, then what Paul pleads for here is something that we need to explore. And that is what we will do throughout the course of the sermon. But before we do that, before we dive further into Ephesians 4, let me show you something that I brought with me. This is a paracord bracelet. It is made of blue and black 550 paracord. Now, it's probably about 8 inches long. It's very stout. What you might not see, because we only ever have one person, Mr. Shell, sitting in the front row, is the locking mechanism. The clasp is a really nice bronze bearer clasp. You basically put the two ends together, and you have a little pin that sets it. And when this is on your wrist, it is very, very hard to get off, which is probably why I don't put it on very often, because A, it's really hard to get on, and then it takes me about 5 minutes to get it off my wrist. but it's one of the few pieces of jewelry I own. And jewelry is a stretch. It's a 550 paracord bracelet. Now, bear with me. Come on, I gave you the setup. Now, you didn't fall for it. Anyways, bear with me for a moment, and I'll explain why I am sharing this with you. Paracord, the material the bracelet is made from, is a lightweight nylon rope that is made up of several or multiple inner cords. Now, each inner cord of this paracord is its own three-strand nylon braid. So if you were to open up the paracord, you would see multiple inner strands of nylon cord located within it. I think of the statement when we talk about three-cord or threefold braids. What does Ecclesiastes say about that? It is not something easily broken. Now, paracord was originally designed for airborne military units and the suspension lines used for parachutes, hence the name paracord, because it was for paratroopers. Now, that number that I stated, that 550, you may see this when you look at paracord online. It may say 780, it may say 200, it may say nothing, and then it may say 550. You want the ones that actually say a number, because that actually indicates the strength it takes to snap the paracord. So the higher the number, the more amount of force required to actually snap the paracord. So as you can see with this particular paracord, since it's made out of 550, there's two particular ropes in here. It would take a lot of effort to snap this bracelet. Now, I'm sure there are those of you who hunt and rock climb and use this material. It is a fantastic invention. Now, let me explain why I mentioned this in relation to Ephesians 4, verses 1 through 6. When we stop and focus on what Paul is communicating here, it begins with a plea, a call to action. He beseeches the members of the church. I, Paul, a prisoner, a person bound captive by the Lord, beseech. Now, that word beseech could mean call on, summon, beg, entreat, console, encourage, exhort, or instruct. I encourage, exhort, or instruct you to walk worthy of the calling with which you were called. You were called, past tense. You answered, past tense. You are walking, present tense. So walk in a manner worthy of the sacrifice of Christ. This is how he starts the first verse of Ephesians 4. And then he begins to list out several attributes, does he not? Each attribute listed here, to make an analogy, is like the individual inner strands of nylon that go into this overall paracord rope. Paul lists out lowliness, gentleness, long-suffering, and endeavoring or bearing with one another in love. These are the individual inner cords. They have a technical term for this when it comes to paracord called the guts. These are the innards of the rope. And they have a ton of tensile strength and utility on their own. Paul then sheathes them. He wraps them and says, here in this overall notion, I want you to remember what they're aiming for, what the overall rope is, and that is to endeavor to keep this single cohesive cord, endeavor to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. In the bond of peace. So I'll go back and I'll show this one more time. So you have the inner strands, you have the overall paracord rope, and you have the clasp, you have the bond of peace. And this is just the first three verses of Ephesians 4, verses 1 through 3. So we have these individual strands, we have the casing, and we have the clasp. And this rope should be strong, and so should the clasp. As we, the church of God at Cincinnati Dayton, imagine if Paul was writing this letter to us and we were seeing it for the first time. When we look at this letter, we would want to take a closer look at each one of those attributes and to understand what he means by saying those things. What he means by saying keep or endeavor, strive intensely for the unity of the Spirit, keeping the bond of peace. We want to understand that. Remember, there's significant relevance to the holy days. Now, I would be remiss in not mentioning that each part or each strand is really a huge topic on its own. When you think about lowliness or gentleness or long-suffering or love or unity or peace, which how many sermons or how many articles, how much investment have we made into those particular topics? They are broad, broad topics with a ton of meaning. But we're going to try to look at it in this narrow confinement like this paracord. How does these inner strands interact with unity? How does unity interact with the bond of peace with keeping this reference of the upcoming holy days? So there is a ton of breadth here to cover. My hope is we can look at these items, understand their purpose and their utility, and learn how to use them or reflect on them in our upcoming festival season. To begin, I want to look at the casing material first. So not in Ephesians 4, verse 2 with the inner strands, but I want to start with unity. When we look at the words unity, or unity of the Spirit, what do we think it means versus what God says it means? Does our human understanding match what God lists out within the Bible? I tell my kids, I tell my wife, and I tell others too, even though sometimes they don't want to hear it, don't let your assumptions get away of the facts, or I don't necessarily say it as that elegantly as like assumptions are killers. Well, we can kind of have the same notion when it comes to the English language. We can hear the word unity, we go, oh, that's what it means, and then we look in the Bible and we go, oh yeah, we're missing a few elements here. And I think when we look at what the human definition of unity is and the definition that's related in the Bible, there is some greater intent to what God is saying here. So what does unity mean according to man, and what does it mean here in Ephesians 4 when it is said? The Oxford Dictionary says there are five possible interpretations of the word depending how or where you use the word unity. Five possible definitions. We're going to focus on two. Just two, which are, in a sense, quite relevant. Unity can mean the state of being in agreement and working together, the state of being joined to form one unit. Not a terrible definition, pretty good one. It's basically saying that from a unity standpoint, if you are working together on a common purpose, you have unity. The second definition is this: a single thing that may consist of a number of different parts. For example, the human body, it works in unity. It consists of multiple different parts. This is how in the English language we give utterance to the word. I was thinking about this. When we refer to unity, generally speaking, in the world, it is a very fragile thing. We're very good at kind of coming to an agreement on a single item, and then everything else, well, that's negotiable. And even sometimes when we talk about that single item, we're not always necessarily very strong in keeping that unity together. But there are positive examples that we see in Scripture where people do have a strong sense of unity. We see it, for example, in the Old Testament, where the people come together for a common good over a period of time. We see it also in some negative aspects as well, too. Let me give one positive example of this in the Old Testament. It's a very positive example of unity. It comes from the book of Ruth. Now, we won't turn to the book of Ruth. There's only really one verse that I want to, or two verses that I want to read from it. But let me give you a little bit of the setup. In the book of Ruth, right in chapter 1, it tells us that Naomi and her husband, along with her two sons, moved from Jerusalem to the country of Moab. Moab is neighboring Israel. They have gone there to live. And in the process of that, her husband has died, but her two sons have married two women from the area, Orpah and Ruth. And they live there for about 10 years. Then what happens? The two husbands perish. And eventually, Naomi decides that I'm going to go back to Jerusalem. Now, when this happens, she tells Orpah and Ruth the following. She says, Go return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest each in the house of her husband. So she's saying, okay, look, I'm releasing you from the covenant of marriage. You don't have to stay here with me. I am leaving. I'm going back to Jerusalem. And they both hear this, and they both cry at the situation, basically saying, we don't want to be separated from you. We want to stick together. We are a unit, a family. And Ruth, or Naomi, hears this, and she basically says, no, I'm going back, and if we follow the law according to my people, you would have to wait till I get remarried, and then I would have to have children, and those sons would have to grow up, and then you would be able to get married again. And that's not something that really would work. And so Orpah basically agrees, and she stays in Moab. But Ruth, on the other hand, demonstrates a real honest level of commitment here. She says, entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from you after following you. For wherever you go, I will go, and wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts you and me. End of quote. It's just a rough summary of, you know, book one of Ruth. Now, this is a tremendous example of unity. Absolutely tremendous. They loved and cared after each other. They were united in being a family unit, even though they could have both basically gone their separate ways. And there would have been no hardness there. But Ruth did not want to be separated from Naomi. She saw her as family. She wanted to be with her. And that carried them through some very tough times. It's one of the wonderful things about unity is it can carry you through some very rough times. And they were blessed as a result of it. Now, there is an element to unity missing here, at least according to the Oxford at least with the way the Oxford Dictionary outlines it. And that's where we'll come back to in Ephesians 4. In the Greek text of the New Testament, if you were to open up an interliterary Bible and look at Ephesians 4, verse 3, you would see that the word for unity is called henotes, H-E-N-O-T-E-S. Always try to think, it's like, if you're going to say a Greek word, try to get it right. So I had all the phonetics, I had the spelling, so I think I got that one. It's a little bit of an easier one, but henotes, that is how it is defined or spelled within the Greek Bible. And it means oneness, especially the God-produced unity, oneness between believers, i.e. the harmony from sharing likeness of the nature of the Lord. notice the expanded definition of unity in that meeting. It is a oneness, especially the God-produced unity between believers. Now, what's interesting is if you look, at least in this particular word, in Ephesians 4:3, it is only used here, and it is only used one other time later in Ephesians 4, verse 13, when it basically says, may you come to the unity of the faith. That's the only two times that this word actually occurs in the New Testament. Now, God says a lot about unity outside of that. In Ephesians 4, the unity of the Spirit eclipses or is more than the together being in a state of being joined together to form one unit. The unity of the Spirit, the unity Paul tells us to strive and endeavor to keep, being clasped in the bond of peace, is a state of oneness produced by God. When you look at those inner cords, as you see in Ephesians 4, verse 2, you see these are things that help lead and strengthen unity overall. There are characteristics, there are attributes. They're a part of being united, having those attributes, because they come from the character of God. If you were to look in, for example, inside of Galatians, and you would look at the fruit of the Spirit, you would see those elements listed there. True unity is sharing the harmony that stems from having the likeness or nature of God. That is what true harmony and true oneness or unity is, at least according to the Bible. These are cords. This cord should not be fragile, should not be made fragile or thought of fragile. It should be able to bear weight and carry us through. The unity produced by the Spirit should be made of sterner stuff. Paul gives an expansion on this later in verses 4, 5, and 6. He draws and says, okay, these are the individual attributes that make up unity, but here are some other things that go into it. And he expands the definition, gives it more oomph. He says there is one body and one spirit, just as we read. Just as you were called in one hope of your calling. He's reemphasizing unity. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is above all and through all and in you all. Now, with that said, if you look at the definition of unity, having oneness with God, and you look at what's being said in verses 4, 5, and 6, then you can ask some questions. Can the body, an individual or the church, be at odds with the Spirit? Can we be at odds or separated with the hope of our calling? Now, the answer to that would be sure if you're looking to be disunited from the Spirit. If you're not looking for the totality of being in the likeness of God. So you want the opposite of that approach. You want to be united. We want to be united. Let me put this in context of the Passover. If I approach, or anyone approach, the Passover ceremony, the foot washing ceremony, taking the bread and wine, being puffed up, insincere, harsh, insolent, the opposite of the words stated in Ephesians 4 through 1 through 6, basically having an unrepentant attitude, being in a state that's contrary to the unity of the Spirit, what is going to be the outcome? Not a good one. Doesn't work out very well. The very outcome of the Passover and days of unleavened bread, even Pentecost and trumpets and atonements, Feast of Tabernacles and the eighth day, should be a greater sense of unity. It's not the opposite. They are meant to strengthen the bond, strengthen the rope. They should secure our relationships. Let me take this a little further. If unity is having the likeness or sharing in the harmony of character of God, let's look at a few examples. Turn over to 2 Corinthians 13 and verse 11. 2 Corinthians 13, verse 11. Finally, brethren, farewell. Be complete. Be of good comfort. Be of one mind. Live in peace. And the God of love and peace will be with you. You have to be in a state of unity to be able to be of one mind, to live in peace, to have God live with you. Philippians 2. We'll go to Philippians 2, verses 1 and 2. We'll see a very similar statement again. Philippians 2, verses 1 and 2. Paul writes, therefore, if there is any consolation in Christ, if any comfort or love, if any fellowship of the Spirit, if any affection and mercy, fulfill my joy, being like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind. All of these things are stating or pointing towards having a unity of the Spirit. I'll read one last one in Matthew 18, verses 19 and 20. Christ speaking says, again, I say that if two of you agree on earth concerning anything that they ask, it will be done for them by my Father in heaven. For where two or three are gathered together in my name, I am there in the midst of them. It's the unity of the Spirit. It is something that we must endeavor to go after, to have in our lives, to make sure that it is strengthened and secured, because it is a oneness produced by God that is part of our faith, is part of our God's likeness, and therefore should be part of ours. Defines our relationships, defines what God wants to have with us and what we are to have with each other, just as he has with the Son. He has perfect unity with the Son. He wants the same thing for his children, for those who will be called sons and daughters of God. Now, I want to be clear, because I always feel like when you use certain words within the church, unity being one of them, giving some church history that we have had, that they occasionally may trigger, for me, it's like a little bit of a flashback, because you think back within 10 years or within 25 years, some of the things that have happened within the church. But I want to be clear, I am not suggesting, implicating, dropping hints as, inferring anything of the sort that there is any issue of unity in the local congregation or the church. We do a very wonderful job. We do a very wonderful job of having unity. I was thinking about this, was the secret pals. What a wonderful way to invest in unity in the church, because you are creating a relationship between children and adults that are not their direct parents. Wonderful way to create unity within the church. Something that I just love seeing. My daughter was saying, I think I know who it is. Now, based off of what I have heard, she's completely wrong. But, you know, she'll find out. She'll find out. Now let's transition over to the bond of peace. The bond of peace. If unity of the Spirit is the overall paracord rope, then the bond of peace is the clasp. It is how we secure unity. We secure it through the act of peace. Now, peace can mean a lot of things. What is the peace described here in Ephesians 4? If unity is something we are striving to keep, then what type of peace securely fastens it? In my estimation, and this is just my guess, there are at least four kinds of peace. There may be more, but there are at least four that I can identify. There is a peace that is passive and occurs naturally. You see it in nature. Now, in my house, it doesn't exist after 6 a.m. because after that point, children wake up. It's always funny. I see my wife. She gets up right about 6. The alarm goes off, and she's very quiet. She's trying to get to the door away from Catriona, and she opens up the door. She pulls it back open. You can see her peeking. is the coast clear? And then she kind of stealthily walks down the hallway, hoping not to be accosted by two wild animals, to get to her coffee. Now, I tell you, sometimes that works. And then there are other times she opens that door, and literally, there's Cleese smiling. And there's Liam wrapped in a blanket. No chance at peace for the rest of the day. Zero. Zero. There is a peace that occurs naturally. I don't wake up at 6, so I have no idea what it's like anymore. Now, there is a second type of peace. Now, this deals with social and political peace. This is a peace that deals with the absence of violence and or fear of violence, along with there being structures in society to promote positive conditions. Now, it is not my intent to cover this type of peace, but we know it is a fragile peace in the earth. Frankly, one that's becoming more and more of a rarity. Always something going on. However, I will say this. There is a time coming, a time that we picture, a time that we are looking forward to, where there will be enduring peace that will be directly influencing the social and political climates of the world. It will be a true government of peace. It's interesting, if you look at Isaiah 9, he doesn't say it's something that is static in scope. He says it is something that increases. He says peace is my government of peace will increase. It will grow. And that will happen when the current ruler of this world is put away. That is the second type of peace. Now on to the third kind of peace. And this is where we start getting into Ephesians 4. There is a quote-unquote inner peace. I don't know if I like that term, but there's a quote-unquote inner peace that you can experience internally that is much more valuable and makes us much more resilient to the trials of life. This is a peace that increases and is directly influenced by the pursuit of obtaining unity of the Spirit. As we seek God and his nature, as we understand what his will is, and we, as a result, grow in his character, we will therefore grow in peace. What I am driving at here is that peace is a byproduct of living God's way of life. When you have answers to big questions, it gives you a sense of security and being able to handle trials as they are thrown at you. There is one thing, if always kind of think about this, is what piece of advice could I give to a younger generation going through their early 20s? Like, don't lose track of the truth. Don't lose track of it, because that peace that is given to you there can sustain you through what will be a significant growing period over the next 10 years of your life. This is the third type of peace. And it is the one that I think, at least in my opinion, is that the one that Satan tries to disturb every time of year. It's the one where he really tries to drain the reservoir pool and make you just not feel like you can handle the trials and the distractions of life, especially when you're coming up against Passover and the days of unleavened bread. Now, there is one more type of truth, or peace, excuse me. And this is the peace that is being referred to in the active sense here in Ephesians 4. This is a peace that we actively participate in the creation of. God tells us repeatedly throughout the New Testament, pursue peace. Pursue it with your neighbor outside of the church. Pursue it with your neighbor inside of the church. Pursue it with your relationship with God. Make peace if you want to have unity of the Spirit. This is how you clasp it together, how you secure it in place, by making peace. Expositor's Daily Study Bible says, for example, peace is the clasp that ensures that this God-given unity will not fall apart. Is the bond that strengthens rather than hampers. This is also why when you see in Matthew 5, Christ says, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God, because they actively pursue peace. They secure it in their personal lives. Now, how you do that gets us to the beginning of Ephesians 2. There are tools, there are attributes of Christian character that go into making peace, that goes into achieving unity and maintaining unity of the Spirit. So with the time remaining, I want to go through these four inner chords. So one verse before Ephesians 4, we have Ephesians 2. And this is the four inner chords: lowliness, gentleness, long-suffering, and bearing with one another in love. When we look at unity of the Spirit, when we look at the bond of peace, these inner chords help gird the strength intrinsic to them. With all of them, you can achieve unity. There is also other fruit of the Spirit that you could involve in this conversation, but Paul only lists out these four. If one of these chords break, or you take one of these chords out, it significantly weakens the overall rope, if not outright makes it so that it will break. So let's look at the very first one, lowliness. Now, lowliness is not something we commonly use in our vernacular. We don't go around saying, that person's very lowly in nature. Just not the way we say it. Humility is more of the language that we talk about. We say humility. Humility is both passive and active. It is the attitude of mind that esteems other better than ourselves and realizes our spiritual poverty and powerlessness in comparison to God. It is an essential character trait for Christianity. I read several articles in Life, Hope, and Truth, along with several other commentaries, and you can see that a lot of times it starts with humility. They say humility is the defining or initial character trait that you have to enter in, because every other subsequent character trait is built off of that. And you see some proof to that, in Matthew 5. It starts with humility in Matthew 5 in the Beatitudes. It's only with a humble spirit is the rest of the character attributes able to develop. Let me give an example. You want to turn over to John 13. John 13. We find the account of Passover, John 13. We will read this again in 10 days. Always look forward to hearing the whole story. Just getting it uninterrupted, no distractions, no noise, just getting the story of the Passover and experiencing it. John 13 and verse 1. Now, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. So I'll pause here. The time has come for Christ to institute the New Testament Passover. We're at the point switching from the old to the new. It's an active transition. He's about to institute the new Passover ceremony. Think about that for a moment. Let your brain pivot around how significant that moment was. It's a tremendous, tremendous moment. And so then we get to the actual ceremony. And it says, continuing on, and supper being ended, the devil having already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given him all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going to God, rose from supper and laid aside his garments, took a towel, and girded himself. And then we get into the act, something that Mr. Stoner said he was thankful for in his sermonette. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. Then he came to Simon Peter, and Peter said to him, Lord, are you washing my feet? And Jesus answered and said to him, what I am doing you do not understand now, but you will after this. I'll end here. When we show up at the Passover, those of us, all of us will be there that are baptized members. We are there because we have committed to the remission of our sins and the transforming of our character. What is the very first activity as a group we will perform? The washing of each other's feet. It starts off, if you think about it this way, the start to the entire Holy Day festival season from beginning to end starts with humility. It starts with us showing ourselves more willing to put someone else over us, to get down and wash somebody else's feet. Just like Christ got down and washed Peter's feet. It starts with humility. It's truly the first act that we get to do as a group, how we start the holy days, displaying ourselves in lowliness or in humility. And this is why it's the inner, one of the inner cords. If we could say what the inner cords are spun from, I would say this one is strung or spun from gold, because it really sets the tone for everything that follows it. Now, this brings us to the second strand, which is gentleness. When I began working on the sermon, I think, to be totally transparent, this was probably one of the hardest words in the Bible for me to write about. Why? The definition, it's like chemistry. Basically, when you look at the definition, it's basically saying there is a certain amount of strength held in reserve, avoiding unnecessary harshness while not being slow to act. Okay, that's what they have as a Greek definition for the word. Strength, having strength held in reserve, being gentle. It sounds like there's a seasoning or a recipe. It's like, okay, what goes into that recipe? How can I be gentle? How can I learn gentleness? How can I learn gentleness? Let me posit it this way. If humility deals with our attitude towards one another, if humility deals with our attitude towards one another, then gentleness deals with the balanced manner in which we act towards one another. Deals with the balanced manner in which we act towards one another. Give an example in Matthew 23. Christ is speaking to the multitudes. And his disciple and the disciples, and I mean, he spends pretty much from like think verse 1 almost all the way up to verse 36, absolutely going after the scribes and the Pharisees. He is taking them to task. In my mind, I want to be like Mr. Myers. He's like, "Are you kidding me?" He says it really well. I mean, he really goes after, you know, the attitude that Christ is looking at this situation, and he is saying these people are suffocating the ability for faith to grow in my people with the burdens of the laws that you have placed upon them. And he is upset. He is righteously upset because of what they're doing. But then he says in verse 37, "O Jerusalem, O Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How I often wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing." Even in the anger that he has that is righteous over what the Pharisees are doing, he still has gentleness in his heart. Gentleness in his heart. Gentleness towards the scribes and the Pharisees, because he knows that they're at one point going to be potential part of his kingdom and his family. Gentleness deals with the compassionate manner with which we deal with others, just as God has dealt with and deals with us. When you and I eat unleavened bread during the upcoming holy days, we are picturing living in righteousness and putting righteousness in. We want to have that. We also want to have the same level of growth in gentleness, which is one of God's characteristics. We want to grow in gentleness and understand what is the right manner of strength that we have to have towards each other so that we handle things in a manner that unifies rather than tears apart. This brings me to the third chord, long-suffering. Long-suffering. If you follow me, if you can give me a moment, if humility deals with our attitude towards others and gentleness deals with the balanced manner, you kind of get these two if statements, then long-suffering deals with our patience. Long-suffering deals with our patience. But there is a little bit more to it than that, than just saying patience. To truly describe what long-suffering is. This is what it says it is according to Life, Hope, and Truth when it goes on the journey of the fruit of the Spirit, when it's talking about long-suffering. It says there is some level of nuance here. Long-suffering isn't just the ability to wait out things without ever getting angry. Helps describes it as divinely regulated patience that results in waiting sufficient time before expressing anger and avoiding the premature use of force or retribution. In other words, long-suffering doesn't mean we never get angry. Long-suffering means we get angry at the right time, in the right way, for the right reasons, which is every bit as difficult as it sounds. Every bit as difficult as it sounds. Now, there are various ways we could look at long-suffering at this inner chord, at endeavoring to keep the bond of peace. I'd like to try a little bit of a different tact with this particular one, with humility and with gentleness so far talked about it in terms of us displaying it. I'd like to take a little bit of a different tact with this one. Imagine there is a spiritual digital clock. Now, I could see one right behind me or in front of me, whatever direction I'm standing in. A spiritual digital clock, and you can't see it. You cannot see this spiritual digital clock. It is counting down. It's counting down from the second Passover starts to the second the Feast of Trumpet starts. There is a countdown from this particular time. From the first action or activity of Passover from sunset all the way to the start of trumpets. There is a clock ticking down. If you could then please turn over with me to 2 Peter 3. 2 Peter 3. There's this clock, it's counting down, we can't see it. 2 Peter 3. And we'll pick up in verse 1. The Apostle Peter wrote the following. 2 Peter 3, verse 1. Beloved, I now write to you this second epistle, in both of which I stir up to your pure minds by way of reminder, that you may be mindful of the words which were spoken by the holy prophets and of the commandment of us, the apostles of the Lord and Savior, knowing this first, that scoffers will come in the last days, walking according to their own lusts and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. Continues on, he says, For this they willingly forget that by the word of God, the heavens of old and the earth, standing out of water and in the water, by which the world that then existed perished, being flooded with water. But the heavens and the earth, which are now preserved by the same word, are reserved for fire until the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. So I'll pause there. Peter says, look, I'm sending this letter to you to remind you that judgment is coming. There is a countdown. There is a clock. Be mindful of all the things that you have been told. People are going to say he's not coming. Don't listen to him. Because he is, and he's going to, and when he does, he's going to bring judgment. And then Peter continues on and says the following. But beloved, do not forget this one thing, that with the Lord one day is 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. The Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some count slackness. And then we get to the word. But is long-suffering towards us, not willing that any should perish, but all should come to repentance. The Apostle Peter says, look, there is a clock running. There is a time limit. There is a countdown. God is extremely patient. He is long-suffering. He is long-tempered. But at some point, he is going to say that enough is enough, and he is going to take action. And we'll continue on and read the rest of the verse. But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness? So there's this clock, it's running, and it's counting down. What manner of person will you be when it strikes zero? Will you have successfully managed or endeavored to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace? Will you be with a or have a long-suffering attitude or approach towards others, just as God has a long-suffering or long-tempered approach with us? Have we hit the mark, or we missed the mark there? Again, long-suffering is part of his character. It's something that we have to develop. If unity of the Spirit is equal to sharing in the likeness of God, we have to equal in sharing or demonstrating the temperament of long-suffering. Now, this brings me to the last attribute listed in Ephesians 4 and verse 2, love. With humility, gentleness, and long-suffering, I've treated them as their own distinctly braided threefold cords. And you could certainly do this with love. But I'll take a little bit of a different tack with this one as well, too. Since godly love is distinct, it is also tightly woven into all of the other attributes. To make an analogy here with this paracord bracelet, if I take a knife and I were to cut open this paracord bracelet and I were to pull out the three cord inner strands, each one of these three cord nylon strands are made out of the material of nylon, made out of the material of nylon. It's intrinsic, it's part of the character, it's part of the makeup or composition of this paracord bracelet. When you look at the inner cords, you look at unity. It is defined by or part of having the entire composite of love. When you look at humility, love is involved with that. You look at gentleness, love is involved with that. Same with long suffering. It is woven into the attributes of all of the other characteristics. Now, one of the interesting things about nylon, and if you take this and make it into an analogy dealing with love, the inner strands have the ability to be resilient. They don't absorb negative things. Like, for example, nylon doesn't absorb water, dirty water or oils or certain chemicals. It's resistant to those properties. When love is instilled in our character, makes us resistant to some of the things that pollute this world. It has a variety of capabilities. It really helps us to be resistant, and it helps us to do those other character, those other inner cords more successfully. It encompasses all of them and strengthens all of them. We'll turn over to one final scripture, 1 Corinthians 13. 1 Corinthians 13, and we'll look at verse 1. He speaks to the importance of love and how it interacts with all of these other gifts, with all these other character attributes that make up God's character, that are part of having unity of the Spirit. 1 Corinthians 13, verse 1. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I have become sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains, but not, have not love, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me nothing. So Paul's saying, look, if I have not love, if I don't have this particular attribute, what is the point of all these other things? Essentially, nothing. Christian love must saturate, infuse, permeate all of the actions or characteristics that come along with having unity or the likeness of God. It is something that has to be there. And then describes the qualities, as we'll read on in the following verse, in verse 4. He says, love suffers long. It is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself. It is not puffed up. You see all of those attributes that are mentioned in Ephesians 4, verse 2, being mentioned here. It is not puffed up. It does not behave rudely. Does not seek its own. Is not provoked. Thinks no evil. Does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in truth. Bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. When this character attribute fully takes hold in our character, it makes those inner strands, if done properly, unbreakable. It can make them unbreakable. When we look at the constructions of Ephesians 4, love, godly, selfless love permeates the entirety of those verses. True humility cannot exist without being saturated in godly love. Same with gentleness, same with long-suffering, and unity as a whole with the clasp of the bond of peace. It is a perfect material for all of these items. This is something that we are building in our character and thinking about as we approach Passover and the days of unleavened bread. In conclusion, brethren, as I draw the message to a close, when we look at Ephesians 4, it tells us that we are to walk worthy in the manner from which we are called. Walk worthy. Walk in a manner that has the same unity and characteristics and attributes that God calls us to have. He says that those attributes start with humility, that builds towards gentleness, it builds towards long-suffering, and it builds towards this overall unity that we are to have in our personal relationships, that we are to have as a church, that we are to have as a people, finally united in the kingdom. But it starts with us walking in a manner worthy of God and zealously or passionately endeavoring after those elements.